The statistics are impressive. The reality is, if anything, more dramatic. In the 20 brief years since statehood, Israel's population has trebled. The value of her industrial production has grown tenfold. That same period of time, the standard of living has risen from that of an emerging, almost economically primitive nation to a level which rivals many of the states of Western Europe. Perhaps alone among the nations of the world, Israel has emerged, come out of backwardness, come into the light of the technological age. It has achieved this without revolution, without violent disruption of its political forms, without an economic overplanning which destroys and circumscribes the rights of the individual, without destroying all that is good and precious in its spiritual tradition. When we visit Israel, we see the new cities, the apartments, schools, the roads, the green hills. In our mind's eye, we see the emptiness, the waste, the sand, the barrenness, the gray rock. Just a few years ago, when Israel was not only almost uninhabited, but largely unwanted. And though there have been occasional moments of economic reorganization of what the Israelis call mitun, means taking oneself in hand, drawing the belt a little tighter, almost all of the indices of economic progress have been upward. The economy has moved at forced draft. All of the indices of civilized life have been upward, onward. 20 years ago, there were 1,300 schools. Today, there are 5,000. 20 years ago, there were 2 universities. Today, there are 5. There are hospitals and clinics, symphony orchestras, theaters, libraries, all the wonderful appurtenances of a civilized nation, and a standard of social welfare, perhaps unrivaled in the world. Israel has come of age. The Israelis have won through to that security which allows them to be warm-hearted and a bit acerbic, indeed a little bit humorous about their own country. One of the fine humorists of Israel, a man named Ephraim Kishon, summed up his country this way. Israel is a country so tiny that there is no room to write its name on the world map. It is the only country in the world which is financed by its taxpayers abroad. It's a country of boundless boundaries. It's a country where mothers learn the mother tongue from their sons. It's a country where the fathers ate sour grapes and the children's teeth are excellent. It's a country where one writes Hebrew, reads English, and speaks Yiddish. It's a country where everybody has the right to speak his mind, but there is no law forcing anybody to listen. It's the most enlightened country in the region, thanks to the Arabs. It's a country where all the capital is concentrated in Jewish hands, and there is much grumbling because of this. Is a country of elections, but no choice. Is a country which is an organic part of its trade unions. Is a country where nobody wants to work, so they build a new town in 3 days and go idle the rest of the week. It's a country where a slip of paper can move mountains, but all the mountains beget is speeches. It is a country which produces less than it eats, and yet of all places is here that nobody has ever died of hunger. It is a country where nobody expects miracles, but everybody takes them for granted. It's a country where one calls ministers simply Moshe, and then almost dies with the excitement of it. It's the only country in the region whose political regime is the bus cooperative. It's a country whose survival is permanently endangered, and yet its inhabitants' ulcers are caused by the neighbors from upstairs. It's a country where every human being is a soldier, and every soldier is a human being. Israel's accomplishments are rare. And all of us, of course, have taken pride in them. Those of us who have gone to Israel have time and again come back and repeated by now the classic story, which you know so well, of the preacher in Eastern Europe in a small town, the Magid, who regaled his congregation every week about the glories of the Holy Land. When he was coming to the end of his career, the shtetl voted him a trip to Israel, provided him a purse for the trip. He went and he returned. The first Saturday afternoon, he climbed into the bima of the little shul. He began his sermon this way. Dear friends, I want you to know that all the lies I've been telling you all these years are true. A few days ago, Israel celebrated the 20th anniversary of her independence. She had every reason to be exultant, to be joyous. And yet there were heavy shadows overhanging that celebration. Perhaps the celebration itself is symbolic of the world in which Israel must live. She proposed no more than to hold an Independence Day parade in her own capital. And somehow the diplomats of the United Nations and the world blew up this simple need into an international incident. The hot angels who are the diplomats around the United Nations Security Council table suddenly accused Israel of violating the letter of the Armistice Agreement of 1949. Now, one would take their judgment seriously had they been as concerned during 10,000 incidents of Arab infiltration and sabotage, which of course violate not only the letter but the spirit of these armistice agreements. We would have been more patient with their piety if they had spoken out over these long years in which General Nasser has proclaimed unremitting and unceasing belligerency, leading to what he calls the final solution to the Palestine problem. And one could accept the Soviet Union as a statesman, as a nation devoted to peace, if she had not in the last 15 years sent almost $3 billion of sophisticated armor to the Middle East, arms which can have only one aim, an Israeli soldier, bombs which can have only one target, an Israeli city. Now the parade was held, and there were no incidents, no major incidents. The Western diplomats were not in the reviewing stand, and this too is part of the world in which Israel finds herself. For her so-called friends and allies are understanding and sympathetic of the urgency which brought Israel into being and somewhat proud of this newest democracy in their ranks. But their foreign offices are constantly being pressured by oil interests, by commercial interests, by banking interests, by shipping interests, to appease the Arabs. And so they have not fully, easily, naturally aligned themselves with the only democracy in the Middle East. And those nations which have no democratic tradition, which are not concerned with the value of an individual, which look on Israel only as a mini state, which stands in the way of their imperial or communist ambitions in the Middle East, and the words are the same, these states can look without compunction upon the eradication or the elimination of Israel, and go about openly and callously to plan for that eventuality. The single most crucial fact about the Middle East at this moment in its development is that just as the war in Vietnam has become more and more Americanized, so the struggle in the Middle East has become more and more Sovietized. It is the Soviet Union which arms and equips the Arab nations. And were the dangers not so imminent, were the possibilities not so black, one, I suppose, could devise some sardonic humor out of the fact that an aggressively atheist state finds itself in the anomalous position of equipping and arming and guiding a so-called holy war. The Arab world, just since June, has sent to Egypt and to Iraq and to Syria $1.25 billion worth of arms. Translate that into firepower, and you have a potential for destruction greater than that which the Allies and the Axis powers brought into the North African campaign in the Second World War. The Soviet Union has undertaken to send foodstuffs and economic credits to the Arab world. The al-Fatah who infiltrate into Israel come armed with these small mines which have been manufactured in Red China. It is these with which they sow their harvest of explosion. Khan Amer, the base which the Israelis eliminated some weeks ago, the marauder base in Jordan, was staffed by an officer corps which had been trained in Red China. The Soviets are not only sending supersonic planes and supersonic bombers and ground-to-ground missiles, but the technicians and the pilots. The Soviet Union has openly threatened Israel that next time she may not restrain herself and her men may fly side by side with her Arab brothers. And around the world, the Soviet Union has begun a massive anti-Israel campaign, his most vicious outbreak we have seen recently in Poland, when an internecine quarrel within the communist government has been developed along lines which accuse those who are currently out of favor of being anti-Zionist, anti-Israel, or just simply of being Jews. When Abba Iban, the foreign minister of Israel, visited Scandinavia during the last week, he was met wherever he went in Sweden by small groups of communist students with placards saying, "The al-Fatah will win, Palestine for the Palestinians," and that the United Nations, the Soviet Union, has become the great protector, the great white father of the Arab states. They know that whatever outrage they commit, they will be protected, there will be no censure. They know that if they can force Israel's hand to commit some act of retaliation, the Russian government will be the first to accuse Israel of being a militaristic nation, a belligerent nation, contemptuous of human life and of human values. The Soviet Union today holds not only the balance of power in the Middle East, but its decisions will control the fate of the Middle East. And so the time of tranquility is not yet at hand. Israel cannot be secure, cannot feel itself fully secure. And yet the time of anxiety, calling out about, is not also at hand. For as quickly as the Soviet Union has determined for its special interests to infiltrate the Arab world by stimulating their hatred of Israel, by stimulating their potential to destroy Israel, so quickly can the Politburo change its mind. If it finds the adventure too expensive, if it finds, as have every other colonial power in the Middle East, that These powers cannot be coordinated in any single activity. They are at each other's throats more than they are even at Israel's throats. If she finds that her battle with China or the revolutions brewing in the satellite nations preoccupy her so that she can no longer devote her concerns and her energy, if she finds that she is being committed to a war in the Middle East at a time when the United States is increasingly free to move its power westward from Vietnam, for many reasons, the Soviets may in the weeks ahead find it advisable to pull out, to pull back, to restrain. We do not know. This much is certain, I believe. That whatever the headlines, the wishful thinking in our papers, there will be no negotiations now. There will be no meaningful conference in the near future. We all long for peace. But I believe that realistically, the assessment must be that a nation or nations are willing to negotiate only when they stand to gain from the negotiations, and that the Arab states now stand to lose, not to gain. For now they are at the center of world concern. Their nearly bankrupt economies are being shored up by the Soviet Union, by Czechoslovakia, by Poland, and by other nations. Egypt cannot provide enough food for its own people. Yet Soviet ships and Chinese ships come in every week or so into Port Said and Alexandria, bearing the foodstuffs that are required. As long as they can play the international power game, so long will the great powers of the world give them their excess capital, foreign aid, economic credit, military armaments. They stand to gain by tensions in the Middle East. And so long as the Egyptian and Syrian and Iraqi and Algerian governments believe that war is a relatively simple enterprise, you try, you lose a few men, and you try again, your cities are inviolate, unbombed, your countryside is unmarked, your officer corps, that is your privileged class, largely unbloodied and unwounded, so long will these nations feel that they have every reason to attempt a third round, a fourth round, a sixth round in this battle to eliminate Israel. And of course, if from the Arab point of view, Israel were to disappear as a catalyst for the hatred and the passions of their people. If, in fact, the people began to ask the questions about their own economy and their own government, which ought to be asked, what about our revolution? The social reforms that we were promised 10, 15 years ago? Why have our standards of living slipped backward? Why are they more illiterate in the nation? Why is the standard of our health so minimal? Why is our economy nearly bankrupt? Then, of course, there's rebellion. These leaders who have led the Middle East into bloodshed three times in 20 years will find their own blood flowing in the streets. Nasser and Hussein and Attassi and their ilk have very little to gain by negotiating now. And so, as Ambassador Yaring, the man who was sent by the United Nations, has made the tour of the Middle East, he has found reason in Jerusalem, and he has found meeting, but no meeting of the minds, in Amman, Cairo, Baghdad, Damascus. And so he is moving this circus back to New York, not because there is hope that in New York negotiations will take place. The United Arab Republic has said specifically, we will not negotiate face to face. We insist that there be withdrawal before there be any conference. But simply, I believe, because it's gotten too expensive and too complicated for the United Nations to keep circling around among these capitals. Now, there are some who look upon the Israeli position as a form of intransigence, not mulishness. Why, they say to us, cannot Israel make the first gesture? Why can't Israel open up this logjam by withdrawing, by making some concession. The assumption being that once Israel has opened the door and proven its good intentions, the other nations will follow suit. But why should Israel make the first concession? What's to be gained by it? When in the last 20 years have we ever had occasion to believe and to discover that the reasonableness of Israel would be met by a counter-reasonableness in the Arab world? In 1957, after the Sinai campaign, Israel withdrew unilaterally. And the great nations of the world made certain promises to Israel. There would be free and innocent passage through the Suez. There would be free and innocent passage into the Gulf of Aqaba. There would be a United Nations emergency force established permanently at the Straits of Tiran. Gaza and the Sinai would be demilitarized. There would be a United Nations emergency force along the borders of Israel and the Negev. And what was the eventuality? That all the great nations the world really wanted was to be disembarrassed of an international concern. And that once Israel had withdrawn, once the Arabs said they were for the moment satisfied, the great powers turned to other matters, and not one of these promises so clearly made 10 years ago, not one of these promises was lived up to. When an animal of prey begins to show signs of tiredness and of weakening, the animal, which the predator animal, redoubles its efforts, gets ready for the final jump. If Israel were to withdraw now, to make concessions now, it would only inflame the Arab world. They would only feel that Israel's feeling weak again. Perhaps now is the time to strike again. I think all of us should remember that whatever the judgment we might make, however we would like to appear very saintly and very kindly to our neighbors, we do not occupy the position of the Israeli prime minister. But he is responsible for 2.5 million lives, and that he can discharge that primary responsibility only by maintaining Israel's strength at his utmost until there are the meaningful negotiations, the enforceable arrangements, until there can be a detente which is supervised and managed and satisfactory to both sides. I'm a little discouraged at times by some in American Jewry. A year ago, they took great pride in Israel's blitzkrieg war. And then when the fickle opinion of the world turned from David to Goliath, when Israel, because of great courage and great heroism and magnificent planning, was able to achieve a great victory, when all of a sudden friends and neighbors in the community began to say, but why is Israel so militaristic? Why is Israel a Spartan-like country? All of a sudden, we began to clothe ourselves in sanctimonious mantles and to make noises as if Israel should make concessions. Israel, dear friends, does not exist for our benefit. Israel exists to provide security to her citizens. We are part of the Jewish people. But ultimately, the decisions Israel must make must primarily be centered on the well-being and on the security of those who are inhabitants of that land. And if we do not have the uniform approbation of the world, that's the world's problem. Because Israel has acted responsibly and reasonably, and I believe continues to act in that way. Israel has done magnificent things in this past 20 years, especially when we consider the fact that it has had to be a schizophrenic nation, the plow in one hand, the gun in the other. Unlike most nations of the world, most small nations of the world, it has not been able to concentrate solely on the primary things, on economic planning, on social programming, on the development of the educational institution. One eye, one hand has always been on the military, security, defense. When we take this in mind, the achievements of Israel have been remarkable indeed. Now, what of the future? The question of peace in the Middle East is problematic. But every day gained is a day gained. New opportunity. When in the flush of victory in June of last year, many of us in Israel and out of Israel suggested that this little war be called the War of Deliverance. General Rabin said no. That's too presumptuous a title. That'd be called simply the Six-Day War. Now, of course, he said, we have not yet the Sabbath of rest, but at least we have a new week, a new chance. And that is the condition in which Israel finds itself. There is an opportunity. Israel has proven its ability to defend itself, to maintain its society. There are months and years in which to build and to plan and to seek economic and political arrangements which can perhaps defuse the powder keg. There is a sense of national solidarity, of common purpose, to allow this community to defend itself again if defense be needed. Perhaps some in the Arab world have learned that the model which they have built about Israel is a false model. Talk to an Arab diplomat and you find that he refers you always, ultimately, to a single historical event, the Crusades. In the 11th century, the nobles of Europe banded together in so-called religious fervor, and they set out to reconquer the Holy Land from the infidel. And in a series of crusades, they were able to establish small kingdoms, Antioch, in Jerusalem. And for 100 years or more, they held on against Arab attack. And then finally, in the 13th century, these one by one, these little principalities were erased, and the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitallers and the other fighters of the crusade went back to their homes in Europe. These Arab diplomats say, Israel is like the crusade kingdoms. It's a foreign body in the Middle Eastern soil. We will attack, we will attack, we will attack again, and ultimately there will be the last crusade, and ultimately the crusaders will be forced back home. The model is an inadequate one. For it is the crusaders were Europeans, and they were reinforced constantly by other Europeans. They came from Europe, they settled for a few years in the Holy Land, and they returned to Europe, and they were relieved by other officers and other men. Israel is home. There's no other place. Where shall we go, the Israelis say? Can we walk on the water? We've been thrown out of this country and thrown out of that country and destroyed here and cindered there. This is our home, Ein Brera. There's no other choice. So the model which the Arabs have is an inadequate one. They can attack. They can attack again. But the Israelis will defend Israel with all of the heightened ferocity of those who defend the territorial integrity, the territorial imperative of their home, the nest. This is all they have. I, for one, believe that in time, the Middle East will settle down. In time, the Arabs' leaders are going to have to give account to their own people of mismanagement, of abuse, of an economic drain of wealth which has destroyed all their opportunity to move from peasantry, from serfdom, to the opportunity which our age can present. I, for one, believe that this time of accounting is not far behind us. It will come shortly. But I also believe that we had better be prepared for a number of years of concern, of insecurity, of tension. I believe that Prime Minister Eshkol was quite correct when he spoke on Independence Day to the Israelis, and he said, peace is a long way off. And there are two roads which we must walk until that day. The road of defense and security, and the road of economic development and social development. And we must walk both these roads at the same time. And he added, we must count upon our compatriots throughout the world to give us some of the wherewithal, the substance, which permit us to move ahead on both fronts simultaneously. You know, Israel, dear friends, has brought great changes in American Jewry, in diaspora Jewry. Think back, if you will, 30 years ago, before the Second World War. Think back to the rather diffuse and weak organization of American Jewish life. We had some congregations, we had a few social institutions, but there was really nothing which we could call an organized Jewish community. Assimilation was very much the order of the day. There was no tangible focus to Jewish life. Nothing was supremely and self-evidently worthwhile. And then came Israel. And suddenly we had a focus for our energies, a concern which was of the highest order. Suddenly there was a reason to rally together, and rally together we did. And there is a different spirit and degree of involvement and degree of giving and of subsistence in our communities than we've ever had before. Israel has changed the context, the dimension, the nature of American Jewish life. It's given us new life, new vigor. And in return we owe, I believe, to Israel many things. We owe to Israel, first of all, time and service. She is a small country, and not all of her people have all of the talents that this small country needs in this sophisticated age. Many spend large numbers of years in concentration camps, unable to pursue their professions or their studies. And if we have talents and skills which Israel requires, then we ought to be willing for a year or two or more to lend those talents to Israel, to teach, to build, to manage, to lend the skills which a skilled nation yet requires. And some of us may be asked to lend our children, whose young hands and skilled minds are the future of such a state. Aliyah will certainly be one of the basic requirements of the American Jewish community. And beyond this, we must give to Israel of our substance. Allow her the luxury, the urgent necessity of moving ahead, the building of hospitals, building of social welfare programs, and development of her civilization at the same time that she mans her frontiers and looks to her defenses. And each of us in his own way must see that he understands, that he can explain, that he can make clear the basic equity, the basic facts of the complicated diplomacy of the Middle East. There is a massive Arab-Russian propaganda program afoot in our world. Many claims are being bruited about as true, which are patently false. But someone must label them as a lie, as untrue. And there must be some community, we here in America, who will see to it that those in power understand the value to America of a democracy in the Middle East, the basic importance of mutuality between this great power and this little power, these two free powers. We must see to it that our politicians understand that they set principle above oil concessions and exploration rights. Some merchant seamen who want the immediate, proximate reopening of the Suez. All this rests upon our shoulders to understand and to explicate, to make clear. For a long time, we Jews in America have sought really and largely to be generous, to be open, to do all that we could for others. We asked very little for ourselves. Now's the time where we must ask for ourselves. We must ask that others become as interested in the survival of Israel as we are. We must see that those whose religious traditions are other than ours recognize how Israel has, for the first time in history, opened the Holy Land to all peoples, made all peoples welcome at their shrines, given them, in fact, religious control of the shrines that were dear to them. For the first time in history, Muslim, Christian, and Jew can visit any holy place, and those to whom that holy place is sacred control it. The time of tranquility is not yet at hand. The years ahead will be dangerous years. Yet I know that Israel has matured, and I believe that the diaspora has matured to the point where, united, we face the future without fear or trepidation. We are prepared to walk this way, whatever be its cost. We look forward to many more anniversaries, signal anniversaries of achievement. A class in Sunday school was studying the prophet Elijah. The teacher told them the story of how Elijah died and how, as he was walking along near the Jordan River, there suddenly descended a chariot from heaven, and Elijah was taken up in the chariot and brought up into the heavens. And one little boy in the back of the class turned to his friend and he said, "Wouldn't you be afraid of riding in such a chariot of fire?" And the other little boy answered him, "Not if God is driving." Amen.